Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
It came about because somebody said, wouldn't it be a great idea to do a Latino version of One Day at a Time? They came to a Cuban-American family, and they're bringing with them a culture we have not dipped into.
I researched the history of quinceañeras and found out they're totally misogynistic.
She's been reading again. Why do you let her read?
This new cast, I mean, they're brilliant.
If I got bent out of shape every time a man said something stupid, you wouldn't be here.
Well, Justina Machado is a rock. Total humanity. She's a glorious actress. Oh, it's terrible working with Rita Moreno. She's just...
You will never win men over by confronting them. You flirt with them. You hypnotize them. And then you do whatever the hell you want.
What she delivers is utterly unique, and it took 84 years to be her. Week after week, you watch a brilliant comedic actor creating a character. It's a delicious process.
This is it.
It's Dave Player back with you on 720 WGN. So that is Gloria Estefan's version of the classic 70s and early 80s sitcom theme of One Day at a Time that originally starred Bonnie Franklin, Pat Harrington Jr., Mackenzie Phillips, Valerie Bertinelli. And the reboot of the classic sitcom is now available on Netflix, starring Rita Moreno and our guest tonight, Chicago's very own Justina Machado. Hello there, Justina.
Hello there. How are you?
Congratulations on the new series.
Thank you so much.
And you were Chicago's very own, so you were born here in Chicago. What neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up all over the Northwest Side, Houston and Armitage, California and Armitage, Kimbo, you name it, I was there. But my family's now in the Logan Square area.
Oh, cool. And then you went to Lane. Mm-hmm. You went to Lane Tech. I know that.
Right across from
WGN Television, of course.
And is it really?
It's right across the street. Yeah, it's been there forever.
Oh, is it by the McDonald's?
It's right behind the McDonald's.
Yes. Yes, I remember the McDonald's well.
I bet you do. So when did you get the acting bug? Was it before high school, in high school? When did you get the bug?
It was before high school because I had gone to a grammar school in Old Town, Franklin Fine Arts on Evergreen and Sedgwick. And that was an art school. But then I ended up going to a technical school. Technical high school. So that was kind of put on hold for 4 years. And then I had a girlfriend whose mother was an agent, one of my best friends. And she called me up one day and said there was an audition. And basically, I was 18 years old. I had just graduated from Lane Tech, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I went in. And the rest is history.
Oh, very cool. And I know you perform with the Latino Chicago Theater Company as well.
Absolutely, right there in Bucktown. That was really where I got a lot of mentoring from Juan Ramirez, who was our artistic director, and got introduced into the whole theater world and just made me love it even more.
Very cool. And then you moved to New York. Did you do some theater in New York, too?
I did. I did a few things in New York. I did at the Circle Rep Theater. I did some stuff and some little local theater there in New York City, regional theater there. And but I wasn't in New York long because I got a job in Los Angeles, and then I moved to L.A.
Okay, was your first on-screen acting gig, was that an ABC after-school special?
Yes, it was in Chicago.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yes, it was. Yes, and another Chicago native, Marisol Nichols, who's on Riverdale now. We were actually in that together.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it's so interesting. Yes, that was a lot of fun.
It's a bummer they don't do those anymore, because I grew up with those too.
I know. I used to love the ABC After School special.
Right?
I used to love them. I agree. It's such a bummer.
And you did quite a bit of TV and movies. You did NYPD Blue, ER, Touched by an Angel, Early Edition, which was based here in Chicago. Then came The series I remember first seeing you in, and that was HBO's 6 Feet Under.
Yes.
That was a cool, yes. One of the most original, uniquely different series on television, I think.
Absolutely. It's a classic. I think so lucky to be involved in something like that. The dark comedy, just the dysfunctional family, the incredible storylines with another Chicago native, Freddie Rodriguez.
Right, right. So, you played your husband. Yes. Yeah.
So, yes, that was my husband. So, yeah, that was a really magical time. That show was pretty magical.
Well, and you got to know the characters over the course of the series, and that series ending, still to this day, how each character lived their life and how each one of them died was so wildly impactful in every sense of the word.
Best finale ever.
Yeah, honestly.
Anything I've ever seen. Best finale. Yes, it is. It is what they did in that little bit amount of time, just what you said. You saw everything in these little vignettes. I mean, best finale ever.
Yeah, glued to the set when that happened. And I know you've had some other recurring roles, too, and you're doing Queen of the South. That's on USA. But then came One Day at a Time, and created by the legendary producer Norman Lear. Isn't that incredible to be associated with such a legendary guy in the history of television?
Absolutely, because I never in a million years thought I would ever get to work with Norman Lear. He's 94 years old.
I know.
You know,
I just not slowing down, man.
I know. 94 and still incredibly active and still incredibly into it. He's there all the time. It's not just by name that he's associated. He's actually really involved in it.
Wow.
Is he? Oh, yes, absolutely. He's there for the read-throughs. He's there for the run-throughs. He's there for the tapings, because we tape in front of a live audience.
Which I
and
love.
He even warms up the audience. Yes, so do I. I love that. It's because I'm not a fan of a laugh track either. But this is true. They're like one-act plays. And,
what?
You know, to be involved with an iconic show like 6 Feet Under, and then to be able to do another show with an iconic, legendary producer is just incredible blessings. I mean, I never thought, I was such a fan of his. All in the Family, Good Times, The Jeffersons, I loved it all.
Yeah, and he, you know, here's a guy that, you know, you talk about doing it in front of a live audience. You know, he wrote for America, and having that audience there and giving natural reactions, every show was like that. I think in the later years, All in the Family, they actually, and this is the truth, they did not tape it in front of an audience, but they played it to the audience of One Day at a Time. And so you'd sit through One Day at a Time, and then they ask you to stay to watch All in the Family and give natural reactions to the show, believe it or not. Little tie-in there.
I think that is true. I think that I read that in Norman's book.
Yeah,
so
right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But now we have the new One Day at a Time, and the Romanos have been replaced by the Alvarezes, so Cuban-American family living in Los Angeles' Echo Park. And on television, I think about this, there are very few Hispanic families featured anywhere, which is almost 20% of the American population. I mean, that's a big miss.
Yes, it is a big miss. And this is why this show, to me, is so much bigger than just, you know, a reboot, a reimagining, you know, so much bigger than working with Norman or working with Rita. It's actually putting a face out there and representing us the way we want to be seen, because these are universal stories. These are human stories. We just happen to be a Latino cast. And, you know, it's about time that we stop putting our actors of color in box. You know, this is the only thing they can do. This is the only thing they can do. So it's just much more, and I can't tell you how many times, you know, I've gotten a response of thank you so much for letting me see myself up there. Thank you so much for putting us, you know, out there. And also, she's a veteran. Penelope's a veteran. Another thing that we're talking about, and we're raising awareness about. And just the fact that, you know, we are a normal American family that just happens to be Latino.
And I love that about that. So there are some twists in this. It's a familiar story, but you've added some very contemporary storylines that are a little bit more relatable to today's audiences. And then, yeah, you talked about Rita Moreno, another legend, the King and I West Side Story.
Yes.
And, you know, I was a kid of the 70s, Electric Company, you know, Academy Award, Emmy, Oscar. What's that like?
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, it's priceless working with her, and she's just a true artist. She's lovely. She's a team player. I don't know if you've gone through the whole series. I don't know if you've seen every
episode. I've seen the first three, yeah.
Well, she's an 85-year-old woman, okay? An 85-year-old woman who has the energy of a 16-year-old girl. And she's funny. She's everything. She's just everything you would can't imagine. You would imagine Rita Moreno to be is who she is. And it's amazing to work with her. It's amazing to be by her side.
To the one episode, and I said I've seen the first three. The third episode, I think, is what it was, where they opened up with her getting everyone ready for breakfast in the morning and playing her music and stuff. That was awesome. I mean, I laughed my ass off. It was really a lot of fun. And no one has
so
to.
Sexy.
And what was that?
Like, she's very sexy, Rita.
Oh yeah,
like, she's still like really sexy, which I love that. I love seeing that out there, an older woman just being that sexy.
Oh, she still has it. Oh, no doubt. No doubt in my mind. And no one has to see the classic series to watch this one. In fact, I was talking with a colleague, 20-something, who's obsessed with Netflix and has no reference to the 70s series whatsoever, but saw your series and really enjoyed it. And I've seen it too. I think I always get very skeptical about reboots, and I think it's just so well written and so much fun to watch. And I like that it's classically three cameras, because so many of the comedies today are not, but there are some things that are familiar if you watch the old show, like the apartment, which I found very fascinating. Like, I wasn't sure if this was going to be from scratch, but that apartment and the layout of that apartment, because I watched that show, is the set kind of from the original series.
It is, and also we have the apartment number,
right.
And which is. And then we have, of course, Schneider.
Schneider.
A reimagining of a Schneider, which is now a hipster.
Right.
He's now this hipster from Echo Park, which is it's so on point. I live in that, in this neighborhood. I live in the Silver Lake neighborhood, which is right next to Echo Park. And he couldn't be more on point, that character.
I would still say that people who watch the old series would say that Pat Harrington thought he was a hipster back then. The bell bottoms and
they, right? The ladies, and this, and our Schneider is still a ladies' man.
Oh yeah,
and
right.
Our Schneider is still a little bit clueless, as was, and kind of like a fatherly thing, like the old Schneider. So yeah, we kept that too. We kept those little things.
Yeah, and when I look at your background, you've done a lot of drama. What do you think about doing comedy? I mean, do you love comedy more? Was this a really fun experience for you?
It was just a really great character. And it was it wasn't, one of the things I can't stand and I can't do is that very like cheesy 1, 2, 3, setting up a joke and doing that kind of stuff. That's something, I can't do that kind of stuff. This was really a well-written character, a well-written show. And the funny is just naturally funny. We do set up things sometimes because it's a sitcom, so we do have those moments. But for the most part, it's just the funny is in the honesty. And I didn't find it difficult at all. I found it incredibly refreshing. Taking a break from being so dramatic is good.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. And you know what? And great reviews, too. Great reviews for you and the series, and that's got to be very exciting.
It is very exciting because, everyone says they don't care about that, but you really do.
You do, of course you do.
It's like, oh, God, I don't care. I don't care. You're like, and then somebody says it's good. You're like, let me read it.
Right, right.
All of a sudden,
exactly.
You care. All of a sudden, you care if it's good.
Right.
So, yes, it's very exciting. And it's what's really interesting and what's even more exciting than the good reviews that I'm getting is that people are getting the show.
Yeah.
They're understanding it. Yeah. And they're seeing that we're talking about things that are important. And that it's bringing back, the old kind of classic Norman Lear situation. And we have incredible showrunners, Gloria Calderon Kellett and Mike Royce and, Norman Lear and all these amazing writers. And they're just doing such a phenomenal job. That's what, to me, is even more exciting, that they're just getting it.
Yeah, it's honest and it's relatable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's relatable. And I think
absolutely.
That, yeah. Yeah. So do you make it back to the Windy City often? Anything you miss?
Always a hot dog. I'm always in Chicago hot dog, Italian beef. I don't have Italian beef anywhere.
No.
But I make it home all the time. I go home. I was just there for Christmas, New Year's with my family. I don't go home as often as I used to, maybe like once or twice a year, but my family comes out here a lot.
Nah.
But yeah, I'm always in Chicago. I know, right? I'm always there. Definitely during the holidays, I'm always in Chicago.
I have to ask you, because everybody in their own neighborhood has their favorite little hot dog place or Italian beef place. Do you have a favorite that you like beeline it to?
Oh, yeah, but they just closed it. It was on Western and Armitage, Sam's Red Hot.
Oh, yeah.
I've been going there. I was like a baby, yeah. And they just closed it last year. That was the place that I used to go to. And then there used to be a place for Italian beef on California Diversity in Elston, and they closed that one, too. So I got to get new places.
You got to find a new place. Well, next time you're in town, stop by the studio so we can see in person.
I would love that.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, the new One Day at a Time, available now on Netflix. And again, great series. Justina Machado, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Dave.
All right. Well, we're going to look back at my conversation with the legendary Norman Lear, who created All in the Family, Maude, Good Times, and One Day at a Time, including as executive producer of the new series. And we'll do that next on 720 WGN.
Yeah. I think that, if God had meant us to be together, he'd have put us together. But look what he's done. He put you over in Africa. He put the rest of us in all the white countries.
Well, you must have told him where we were, because somebody came and got us.
Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. Television producer and broadcasting legend Norman Lear has enjoyed a long career in television and film, and as a political and social activist and philanthropist. Norman's work is legendary, the renowned creator of such iconic television shows as All in the Family, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Mary Hartman, and so many others. He remade our television culture from the ground up. At their peak, his programs were viewed by 120 million people a week, with stories that dealt with the most serious issues of the day: racism, poverty, abortion, menopause, swingers, politics, and so much more, yet leaving audiences howling with laughter. His signature series, All in the Family, held the number one spot from 71 to 76 in the Nielsen ratings, and it was called the fourth greatest TV show of all time by TV Guide. It earned 22 Emmy Awards, including 4 for Best Comedy Series. And in his new book, Even This I Get to Experience, Norman opens up with all the candor, humor, and wisdom to be expected from one of America's greatest living storytellers. And we are thrilled he's joining us tonight. Mr. Lear, good evening to you.
Good evening to you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, I'll tell you, I read your book over the last week, and it's 92 years in the making. I thought it would be I thought it would be volumes based on your career.
Well, it could be volumes if I told every minute of it, but I spared you that.
Okay, all right, fair enough. Fair enough. And I knew this was a true labor of love. It took you about 6 years to put it together.
It did. Well, I'd been noting. I knew 20 years ago I was going to do it, and I had boxes of correspondence and notes and other projects I worked on that filled in, and other adventures in the media. So I was note-taking in 6 years, actually, in the writing.
So, Norman, it was when All in the Family, you started talking about All in the Family, you brought a British sitcom to U.S. television, but it wasn't an easy road to get that first episode on the air. I think you originally started producing it for ABC.
I did. The ABC bought it, and we made the pilot with Carol O'Connor and Gene Stapleton, two other young people. I knew Rob Reiner since he was 6 or so years old, but I thought him too young for it at that time. And so we had two other young people, but the same script as the one that went on the air eventually. And ABC, they had the right to ask me to make it again, which would hold it for another year, or put it on. They elected not to put it on and had me make it again, so they controlled it for 2 years. So we made it again also with O'Connor and Stapleton and two other young people. And
same script, though, right?
Same script. Well, 100% the same script.
Yeah.
my theory was you can't get wetter than wet. We're going to jump in the water with Archie, 360 degrees of him, and we're going to get wet together. And so it was the same script 3 years later when CBS, a new president, came into that role, Bob Wood at CBS and Fred Silverman, his associate, and they bought it.
But, you know, see, even then, when they bought it, CBS wanted to pull the plug almost at the last minute, right up to the opening.
They wanted to run the second show we made first.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the script that I intended to show 360 degrees of Archie Bunker. So we went to within 20 minutes of the broadcast in the East. In those days, well, still, it's 3 hours later in
sure.
In 3 hours earlier, but 3 hours later in New York.
Well, and what's amazing, right in the opening segment, is what they had a problem with. You know, okay, here we have a married couple. Nothing happened. The camera saw nothing. They just didn't like what was being alluded to. Please explain that.
Well, they walked into, they had gone to church. It was a Sunday morning. It was their anniversary. Mm-hmm. The kids were preparing a surprise brunch for them. Archie hated the sermon, didn't like the pastor either, left the church. They came in arguing about the sermon. And while the kids were alone in the house, which happened very rarely, Mike coaxed Gloria into going upstairs. It was as they were going up and were just lost for a moment at the top of the stairs when the bunkers came in. They came running down. Archie guessed what was happening. And the line that was in contention was, Archie saying, 11:10 on a Sunday morning. And I said, well, it's an innocuous line. But no, it isn't. It's pointed to something we all know what it's about.
Absolutely.
Well, of course we know what it's about, but then again, they're married.
Right.
What's the problem?
Yeah, I guess that it was Sunday. I don't know in this day and age, but yeah.
I don't know. But that was the final that had to come out. Now, that script could have lived very well without that line. So I wasn't fighting for for the line. It was the meaning behind it. It was so innocuous that it was common sense to understand that if I said, okay, let's take that little innocuous line out, that I would lose every battle after that.
Absolutely.
It would never stop.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, I didn't look at it like the giant war it seemed to be in hindsight. It was just, I mean, I can't give into this or the silliness will prevail.
Absolutely. Great hindsight as well. And I know the first show, too, had a disclosure in the beginning of it even, you know, just to warn viewers what they were about to see, which I don't believe there was any reaction. I mean, maybe a handful, but it was like, great show.
Yeah. It was, what do they call that when they, before they put it on, they take it back.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
For mature audiences only.
Yeah, right.
This was a whole paragraph.
Right. Now, hands down, All in the Family is clearly the most, probably one of the most important, if not the most important show of the 20th century. Did you know at the time how important this show was going to be in television history?
No. I was a guy with, I had two kids. And I was fighting to make a living. It was the beginning of a career. And mm-hmm. This was work. We were working. And the other guys and gals were in the same situation. We were all fighting to make a living as writers. The difference, I think, was that I was born into a serious situation.
Yeah.
I got to understand the foolishness of the human condition out of the tragedy and the problems that exist there.
Sure.
So I gravitated to writing out of that. And our little team of writers, this was, you have to remember, a giant collaboration. I mean, I wasn't alone here. And I created the show and the characters, but I had a great team of writers, men and women, who were devoted to it. But they were devoted first to their own families. They were men and women who were married or single and part of the culture. They looked at everything that impacted their kids, their families, and themselves economically, socially, sexually, whatever the
sure.
illness, all of that. And that's what we wrote from, the reality of the lives we were living.
And then in front of the camera, you know, I know Carol, you know, based on what you wrote, he developed his character after a cab driver he knew. What was it like working with Carol O'Connor?
Well, it was as difficult as it could be on the one hand, and it was miraculous and life-giving on the mm-hmm. other. I mean, to see a guy who, he fought a great deal about what he was doing, didn't like this, didn't like that. I came to believe he had to go through something, which only he understood at some real depth. And then he'd come out Archie Bunker. And when he came out of Archie Bunker, there were none of us who could write the dialogue as well as Archie could fume it.
Yeah, right. No, right, right.
It spilled out of him.
But there was a lot of passion, I mean, between both of you, obviously. You running the show, him being the star of the show. I mean, you both, you know, developed opinions, and you learned to work with one another. But, you know, there was a lot of, and I say it with all due respect, but there was a lot of passion on both sides. And so,
oh, there was. There yeah. was a tremendous amount and a lot of anger and so forth. But, I mean, I was so grateful for the character.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these things happen in creative enterprises, and he had his own ideas, and sometimes, by the way, it isn't like the man was always wrong.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
He bettered everything he touched in the long run.
What was your best remembered story working with Carol? I assume it might be the episode when he was stuck in the elevator.
That's the one that leaps to mind, because it was in an elevator, five people trapped in an elevator that got stuck on a high floor. And one of them due to have a baby in a couple of weeks, and the tension and so forth of that moment causes her to go into labor. And Archie was having a relationship with one black dude and this Hispanic couple. And
some of the funniest dialogue ever.
And yes, it was a hilarious situation for him to be in, and I'm sure he understood that. But it was also he was with four players that were not well known. He's the star of the show. It's, you know, he has to deliver in that confinement enormously.
Mm-hmm.
And a baby is going to be born on the floor of that elevator. The camera isn't going to be there. It's going to be on Archie's face. And, I mean, as I say it, I think about how glorious it was as an idea and how super glorious he made it as an actor. That moment is indelible.
Yeah, I mean, just like you said in the first episode, you know, there was a lot of things that were alluded to in the end of this episode. You never really saw anything, but you saw the action and you saw the emotion of what was happening just in Carol's face.
Yes, yeah, and... I can't name, over all the years, I don't know how many actors I could name that could possibly pull that off.
Yeah. Jean Stapleton, I know you had a wonderful relationship with her.
Yes. Jean Stapleton, somebody asked me early in our relationship and the show's history, somebody said, what's Jean Stapleton like? And I heard myself saying, she's always where she is. And there was some time later, I really dwelled on that and thought, oh, my God, how remarkable is that?
Yeah.
She's always where she is. And then I started to reflect on me.
Yeah.
And I couldn't say that and wish to.
Yeah. You know, what were your favorite episode with Gene? As Gene was the focus of so many episodes.
Probably. I don't know what my favorite was. What my mind leaped to was we wanted Jean to lose her faith in God and examine what that would mean. And we found the way easily that would cause that. There was a Beverly LaSalle who mm-hmm. was a transgender.
Yeah.
And Edith looked at her as the woman she wished to be, appeared to be, you know, and it didn't cross, nothing negative crossed her mind, That's who she was. Mm-hmm. And she is killed by a gang for the reason for her sexuality. And Edith can't understand a God who would allow that and loses her faith. And then we had weeks. We couldn't run or make and run the first show without having the second show, Edith gaining it, regaining her faith.
Right.
And it took weeks thinking about that. So we couldn't make the first. We had the script until somebody asked the question, well, what happens to Archie when Edith loses her faith? And we all realized in an instant, he goes to pieces.
Yeah.
He needs her strength, her strength starting with the fact that she adored him, and there's nothing he could say that could stop that. Talk about strength.
Well, there was such depth to everything that you wrote, and of course there was also the remarkable, you know, Rob Reiner and Sally Struthers. So many spinoffs. You know, at a time, there wasn't a lot of spinoffs in the 60s or the 50s. This show, All in the Family, generated so many spinoffs. The first one was Maude, correct?
Yes. You know, the word spinoffs always interested me. I always thought about, you bring on a player that you think can work in his or her own show, and she's kind of a bush league player.
Mm-hmm.
And you're, what you're trying to do is groom her or him for the majors. That was the terminology I always used. Thinking about it. Well, we wanted on All in the Family, we wanted somebody to come along that would reach through the depth of a lot of years to beat the hell out of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, I learned in my family, there's something like an old relative with a grudge.
Yeah.
You didn't invite Gert to the wedding. How could you have done that 27 years ago? That person coming in with that. So Maude was a cousin as a girl and best friend of Edith's.
Yeah, the whole family was sick. The whole family was sick, and Maudie was called to come take care. I remember the episode. It was absolutely vintage because it was the first time I think I saw Archie really beat up by somebody.
Yes. And well, it needed to be Arthur playing that
role.
Yeah. But with that grudge that came back, that came over the years.
Now, from Maude came Good Times. Did you get flack at the time because of the portrayal of this black family, you know, in Chicago, that it was more negative?
We got flack a couple of years in. There was some flack. Some of it was helpful because it was about why is the only black character supporting a family working three jobs? Why is it that's not the truth in America? People move up, move on. And several African-American newspapers carried stories like that or hints of that feeling. And that motivated us. We were thinking about them, the actors, to do the Jeffersons. But it certainly motivated moving on up.
Absolutely. Right. Which I would say you remedied that with another sitcom. So the Jeffersons, and I forgot, you know, obviously the Jefferson's came after Good Times, and it surprises me always because really they were, you know, so prevalent in the first season of the show. When you develop those characters, you know, Isabel Sanford, and I know Sherman Hemsley came a little bit later. Did you ever think in the back of your mind, here is another show, or did it come to you kind of later after you did Good Times?
No, I Bush League characters were everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you couldn't hire a good actor without wondering if that good actor shouldn't move up. And that motivated as much of the thinking as anything else. Wouldn't it be fun to see this glorious performer in his or her own show?
Sure. And then there was One Day at a Time, and I had read that there, you know, when Maude, you know, when the abortion issue came up on Maude, this was a episode originally written for Bonnie Franklin on One Day at a Time. What decided to go a different route and a whole different show with this subject matter?
Well, it was written originally, and not that it was the same script as it, you know, was finally done.
Yeah.
Because Joan Harris, who later created Golden Girls, wrote, is responsible for the abortion episodes on All in the Family.
Mm-hmm.
The one, I can't remember who, but it was the team that wrote it for Bonnie Franklin. But we were, I don't remember exactly why we hadn't made it, but we certainly intended to make it. When somebody came in with a newspaper article about a woman in her 70s that was raped. And as we talked about that, we thought, you know, rape is usually considered what they look for first is what was the girl doing to entice the guy?
Yeah, horrible.
Was her shirt too her skirt too short? Or, mm-hmm. So this kind of thinking and speculation about and certainty that older women, as a result of seeing this story,
mm-hmm.
are raped too, caused us to say, let's do it with Jean and not with a young woman.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, I will tell you, you know, One Day at a Time, Mary Hartman, Fernwood Tonight, Sanford and Son, so many others, Silver Spoons, Facts of Life, Different Strokes, that just came from you, Square Peg.
No, it didn't all come from me. Well, you know, a giant collaboration.
Absolutely. But still, out of all the other shows outside of All in the Family, what show would you say you're most proud of outside of All in the Family?
Well, I would say Maude, Good Times at Jefferson and Mary Hartman.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Mary Hartman was had one spectacular thing about it, and that was that it set up something at the beginning, and, you know, it was on five nights a week.
Yeah.
So there were several hundred episodes. And it concluded on the same thing in which it began. And it wished to explore the impact of the media on a simple housewife. And the media drove her crazy at the end.
Yeah.
And her, on the David Susskind show, as a result of the inquiry of three hard-hitting media bullies. I can't say that, can I?
Whatever you'd like.
They drove her crazy, and that's one of the best acting jobs I've ever seen.
Very cool. Now, I also know you've stayed very active over the decades to speak out for the Bill of Rights. Obviously, producing these shows, I would think you would have to be, and specifically the First Amendment, the People for the American Way. In the late 80s, you began the Environmental Media Association to make sure that the entertainment industry was, you know, environmentally responsible, which is very early on when you think about the late 80s. Declare yourself to get people out to vote. And countless others. And here's a little known fact that I think people might not know. In 2001, you and your wife purchased one of the first published copies of the United States Declaration of Independence. How cool was that?
It couldn't have been cooler. This was one of 26 known to exist in the world. It was the only one in private hands. And it was this group were printed the night of July 4th, 1776.
Wow.
Unlike the one that was signed, that was signed over months, and there's only one copy. But this was printed to be sent by horseback around the 13 colonies, and there are 20-some left. And so I looked at it as our country's birth certificate.
Absolutely.
The night of. And we had the best time in the history of good times sending it around the country with the cooperation of major sponsors and the U.S. Postal Service, and it was fabulous.
Well, that's what I love about it is not only did you purchase it, though, but you took it on the road. You let people see it. You shared it with the country. That's pretty cool.
Well, that was its purpose. No. I mean, I didn't buy it to hang it on a wall.
I hear you. Well, I'll tell you what, nominated for an Academy Award, inducted into the Television Hall of Fame in 1984, four Emmy Awards, a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, the National Medal of Arts, and so much more. Absolutely incredible. And you are a legend in your own time. And I'm thrilled you spent some time with us tonight.
I couldn't have enjoyed it more. Thanks.